Welcome back to the Deep Dive. If the past few weeks have left you feeling like you're constantly playing catch-up with global events, well, you're definitely not alone. We are staring down a 7-day stretch, October 19th through the 26th, that is just so incredibly dense with high-impact economic and corporate reports. It almost feels like the entire Q4 calendar has been crammed into this single week.
It really does. It's a volatility convergence, you could say. We've got crucial policy decisions happening overseas, big corporate health reports dropping one after another, and maybe most importantly, that delayed U.S. data finally hitting the wires because of the shutdown. So our mission today is really to give you a strategic blueprint, you know, a way to navigate all this. We need to cut through the noise and pinpoint not just what's happening, but why it's so critical right now.
Exactly. And we see, sort of, three dominant narratives emerging this week. They're highly interactive, feeding into each other, and honestly amplifying the risk profile. First, we kick the week off with China's critical checkup, the Q3 GDP, and a whole slew of economic data from Beijing landing on Monday. That sets the indispensable initial tone for global growth, for commodity demand, and frankly, the health of emerging markets generally.
Right. Then second, we move into the corporate trenches for what we're calling the corporate report card. A massive slate of U.S. earnings hits midweek. We're talking big names like Netflix, Tesla. It's going to test whether resilient demand, which we've seen pockets of, can actually translate into sustainable profits. You know, with all the pressure from inflation and input costs, really the big margin test for Q3.
Definitely. And then finally, anchoring the entire week, maybe with the most potential for fireworks, we have the rescheduled bomb, that critically important U.S. CPI data for September. It got delayed, of course, by the ongoing federal government shutdown, and it drops later in the week. It promises to basically reset the entire conversation around the Federal Reserve's rate path. One high-stakes moment. Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with the structural risks that are already sort of bubbling under the surface, making the markets extra sensitive right now. So before we even hit that first big data point on Monday, we absolutely have to acknowledge these background structural risks that have been simmering. They're defining what we might call the chronic stress conditions in the global economy right now. And top of that list, obviously, is a political gridlock in the U.S., the federal government shutdown. It's now rolling into day 19.
Yeah, and the length, the duration, that's really the problem here. Investors, you know, they've kind of learned to shrug off short shutdowns. But once you push past that 2-week mark, the impact starts to become corrosive. First, just general market uncertainty goes up. Traders hate political instability. But strategically for investors, it creates this information vacuum. Key official U.S. data, like the original CPI release we just mentioned, or certain trade figures, durable goods reports, it's all suspended.
And that vacuum has a direct knock-on effect on the rest of the week's calendar, right? It changes the game.
It absolutely does. That scarcity of reliable official U.S. data is precisely why the rescheduled U.S. CPI becomes such an explosive event. All that pent-up market anticipation gets released at once. Yeah. And it also elevates the importance, maybe an outsized importance, of private sector indicators. Things like the flash PMIs later in the week, the commentary coming out of corporate earnings calls, even anecdotal stuff like the Beige Book. Investors are basically forced to lean on these alternative, often less comprehensive sources to try and gauge the health of the U.S. economy.
We also can't forget that persistent labor issue hanging over the aerospace sector. The Boeing IAM strike that's now entering week 12, believe it or not, started back in early August.
Yeah, and this is a major structural risk, not just for Boeing stock, but for the whole global aerospace supply chain. The IAM, that's the Machinists Union, they recently filed an unfair labor practice charge. That suggests negotiations aren't just stuck, they might be actively getting worse, raising the legal stakes. For Boeing, this translates directly into, well, severe risks for Q4 cash burn, manufacturing delays, probably further erosion of their delivery pipeline. And for the wider industrial sector, it means chronic pressure on thousands of smaller suppliers who really rely on Boeing's steady production schedule.
And then globally, that geopolitical chronic stress checklist. It remains long, and the stakes are incredibly high.
We have to keep these constant pressure points front and center. The Ukraine-Russia conflict, now past day 974, it's still impacting global energy, particularly European natural gas, global grain supplies. That's like a permanent feature now, adding this unpredictable risk premium. Similarly, the structural issue around Taiwan's Strait tensions, it just requires constant elevated monitoring. It puts the critical semiconductor sector, think TSM, equipment makers like ASML, perpetually on high alert for any supply chain disruption.
And speaking more acute risk, the immediate volatility in the Middle East is tied to the Gaza ceasefire implementation that's moving through days 9 to 11 now. What are the specific market links we need to watch there?
Well, the sources are pretty clear on this. Any credible sign that the ceasefire is breaking down would immediately inject a significant geopolitical risk premium back into energy markets. And it's not just about the headline crude price like WTI or Brent. It's about shipping and insurance costs.
Yeah,
a breakdown of stability pushes up maritime insurance rates for tankers moving through those major choke points, Suez, Strait of Hormuz. That directly feeds into higher Brent crude prices. Plus, you'd see the usual safe haven assets, gold, the US dollar, rally instantly. And we should expect the Israeli shekel, the ILS, to be highly reactive, probably spiking lower on any negative news. The market right now seems to be pricing in a fragile piece, which means the risk is really skewed to the downside if things go wrong. So all these background risks, they create this kind of nervous market environment leading right into Monday, where, as you said, the entire global focus just pivots squarely onto China's economic health.
Okay, so Monday, October 20th. Kicks off the week with a huge bang, this critical data dump from China, Q3 GDP, September industrial production, retail sales. Why is this release the absolute crucial barometer for the start of the week?
Well, fundamentally, China is still the engine for global growth, right? And specifically for global commodity demand. If China slows down significantly, the entire global supply chain feels it, from, you know, copper mines in Chile to manufacturing hubs in Germany, the Australian dollar, the AUD, and global base metals like copper. Those are the most immediate sensitive indicators to watch for this release.
And what are the specific numbers people are watching for? What's the consensus on Q3 GDP?
Consensus is pointing to Q3 GDP growth around 4.8% year over year. Now, that's a noticeable slowdown from the 5.2% they posted in the previous quarter. This expected deceleration isn't really a shock. It's kind of the result of several structural headwinds hitting at once. You've got the fading base effects from the post-lockdown reopening bounce finally wearing off. You've got weaker export growth because demand in key Western markets is softening. And maybe most importantly, that persistent structural weakness in their domestic property sector. It's just acting as a massive drag on fixed asset investment.
Okay, so if the number comes in weak, confirming that slowdown, the usual playbook, maybe the old playbook, would call for massive stimulus, right? That sort of bazooka approach we saw in the past. Is that what the market expects this time?
This is where the policy nuance is just so critical. And the sources we looked at really highlight a major potential shift in Beijing's strategy. The current leadership seems to have made it explicitly clear they're prioritizing long-term quality over short-term quantity. They've signaled the strategic pivot away from just chasing the highest headline growth number at any cost. Instead, the focus is on, quote, tech-focused transformation and investing in new quality productivity development.
Okay, new quality productivity. What does that actually mean for an investor trying to read the policy tea leaves here?
It means a soft GDP number might not trigger that broad credit-fueled infrastructure stimulus that tends to lift the entire commodity complex like it used to. Instead, policy support is expected to be much more targeted, aimed at strategic industries, think advanced manufacturing, green technology, AI. So investors really need to dissect the composition of growth. Where is the incremental spending actually going? That's more important than just the headline GDP percentage. You know, a big chunk of stimulus targeting semiconductors sends a very different market signal than stimulus targeting residential construction.
But the deepest structural risk you mentioned in our prep, it relates to the price environment itself.
Yeah.
Let's spend a minute on this really profound deflationary signal coming out of China.
We absolutely have to. This is arguably the most concerning takeaway from our analysis of the Chinese economy right now. We have to highlight this persistent structural deflationary condition. It's pretty unique to China at the scale. The analysis shows that China's GDP deflator, which is basically a measure of the average price change across all goods and services produced in the economy, much broader than CPI, it's been negative for 9 consecutive quarters as of the last reading in Q2 2025.
9 consecutive quarters? That's significant. Explain why the GDP deflator, maybe compared to the consumer CPI that gets more headlines, is the crucial metric for gauging this deep structural health issue.
Right. So CPI, the consumer price index, it only measures consumer goods prices. And that can be heavily influenced by volatile stuff like food and energy prices, often driven by global factors. The GDP deflator, on the other hand, is a far broader measure of the entire economy's price level. It includes corporate profits, investment prices, even wages implicitly. When that number is negative for this long 9 quarters, it confirms a deep structural problem. Prices for basically everything are falling across the production chain. And maybe even more telling, nominal GDP growth, its growth including inflation, has actually been below real GDP growth for 6 straight quarters now. That's just mathematical proof that growth is being achieved through margin compression. Companies are cutting prices.
So what does that deflationary reality imply then? For domestic businesses, for global companies operating in China?
Well, it has deeply negative implications. First, deflation increases the real burden of debt. If you owe a fixed amount of money, but the value of the assets backing that debt, like property or industrial output, is falling, your debt effectively gets larger in real terms. That puts a huge strain on corporations, local governments, everyone with debt. Second, and this is crucial for global investors, it confirms that any real growth being achieved is primarily happening through margin-destroying price wars and cuts. Companies are just forced to compete aggressively on price, which suppresses profitability right across the board. So if this Q3 data confirms both a softening real growth rate and a worsening price picture, that's just a clear signal of chronic economic weakness, and that will inevitably pressure global corporate assets exposed to China and commodities too.
And in terms of immediate central bank action, the People's Bank of China, the PBOC.
Yeah, the PBOC loan prime rate, or LPR, decision is scheduled right alongside the data dump on Monday. The market expects them to hold steady. That means the one-year LPR likely stays at 3.0% and the five-year LPR, which influences mortgages, at 3.5%. The LPR is China's benchmark lending rate for commercial banks, so holding it steady reinforces that cautious, targeted policy stance we talked about, prioritizing stability over broad stimulus. Now, a surprise cut. That would indicate maybe the property sector crisis has gotten much worse very quickly, signaling urgent concern. That would probably weaken the yuan, but could give Chinese equities a temporary boost on those stimulus hopes.
Okay, so once the Asian markets have had a chance to digest those, frankly, monumental China numbers on Monday, we pivot westward midweek. The attention shifts from those chronic growth concerns over to more acute inflation tests, first in Canada, then the UK. And this happens right as some of the biggest names in US tech are dropping their corporate report cards. This is where that theme of policy divergence really starts to sharpen, doesn't it? Hashtag tag 2.1 inflation tests in Canada and the UK.
Absolutely. Starting Tuesday morning, October 21st, 8.3 Eastern, we get the Canada CPI. This is a very high impact release, especially for the Canadian dollar, the loonie, because it's the final critical piece of inflation data the Bank of Canada, BABC, will see before their rate decision on October 29th.
So the stakes are massive for the BOC's next move. What's the market pricing in right now? What's the baseline expectation?
Consensus is looking for headline inflation to come in around 2.2% year over year. Maybe more importantly, core CPI is expected near 2.7%. Now, the BOC has generally signaled a readiness to ease, or at least a dovish bias, given their own slower growth forecasts. So if this CPI print, especially that core number, comes in hotter than 2.7%, it immediately challenges the timing, maybe even the viability, of those expected rate cuts down the line. That would push the Canadian dollar higher and put upward pressure on Canadian bond yields. We also get the Bank of Canada's Q3 Business Outlook survey on Monday, which gives some anecdotal color business sentiment on sales investment plans. If that survey comes out soft, it could give the BOC cover to justify future easing almost regardless of the CPI headline.
Then on Wednesday morning, very early for us here, 2 a.m. Eastern, the global inflation spotlight swings across the pond to the UK CPI. This sounds like a pivotal release for the Bank of England, the BRC.
Indeed it is. The consensus for the UK headline rate is actually quite a bit higher, around 4.0% year over year. Now, the key thing here is context. This 4.0% number is widely seen by analysts, and importantly by the BOE itself, as a temporary peak. The Bank of England has been very explicit in its forward guidance, saying they attribute this expected rise primarily to energy base effects. Basically, the comparison point from last year was unusually low, creating this temporary statistical jump now.
Okay, so if it hits 4.0%, the market doesn't necessarily panic. It's largely priced in, theoretically.
If it hits consensus, yeah, the market should, in theory, look through it. The focus should remain squarely on core CPI. The consensus there is for 3.7%. You see, the BOE's biggest stated concern isn't the headline number right now. It's persistently high wage growth feeding into sticky services inflation. And that's what core CPI reflects better. So if core CPI surprises to the high side, let's say it prints 3.9% or even 4.0%, that would validate the BOE's current hawkish pause. It would revive bets on maybe further tightening actions later. And that scenario would almost certainly lift the British pound, maybe pressure the FTSE 100 index, and really reinforce that sharp policy divergence narrative, the BOE staying tighter while other central banks are looking to ease.
And we also get some Fed speak, some commentary from the U.S. side, even with the shutdown limiting the actual data flow.
That's right. On Tuesday, Fed Governor Waller is scheduled to give some opening remarks at an event. Waller is generally considered a key voice on inflation and the labor market outlook. Any hints he drops about how the Fed might react to the impending CPI release whenever it comes will be scrutinized very closely by the market. Then on Wednesday, October 22nd, we get the U.S. Beige Book release. This is the Fed's sort of qualitative assessment, a collection of anecdotal reports from businesses across its 12 districts. It offers a timely, boots-on-the-ground look at economic conditions, things like wage pressure, hiring difficulties, general business confidence, right ahead of the next FOMC meeting. If there are widespread reports in the Beige Book about softening economic activity or maybe slowing job growth, that could subtly boost the market odds of future rate cuts, which would naturally put some downward pressure on the U.S. dollar.
Right now for the corporate health check. This could really set the risk appetite for the rest of the week. Tuesday and Wednesday nights bring earnings from two absolute titans of the Magnificent Seven. Let's start with Netflix, NFLX reporting after the bell on Tuesday. It feels like the old narrative, just counting net subscriber ads, is completely retired now.
Oh, absolutely. The focus for Netflix has decisively, definitively shifted to monetization prowess. The market basically accepts they dominate the streaming landscape. The question now is, how effectively are they translating that dominance into actual profits? Consensus EPS estimates are pretty robust, around $6.93, which suggests the street expects strong execution. Investors are going to be laser focused on three key metrics here. First, the specific growth rate and performance of their ad-supported tier. How quickly is that scaling? How much revenue is it bringing in? Second, the average revenue per member or ARPU. How much money are they managing to squeeze out of each subscriber globally?
Okay, ad tier growth, ARPU. And the third key metric.
The third is really the commentary around the success or lack thereof of their paid sharing crackdown. How much of the recent subscriber growth is real organic growth versus just users who are borrowing passwords finally being forced to pay up? A strong result across those three dimensions, ad tier, ARPU, and paid sharing conversion, that would likely lift NASDAQ futures overnight and boost general tech sentiment. It would validate their strategy that, yeah, cracking down on sharing and pushing ads are the keys to juicing future returns.
And that narrative, volume versus profit, applies perhaps even more intensely to Tesla, TSLA, reporting Wednesday night after market close. We already know they delivered a record number of vehicles in Q3, almost 500,000, 497,099 units. So volume isn't the question here. The market focus has to be solely on the profitability of those cars, right?
Yep.
That's exactly right. Despite those record deliveries, the market has already priced in a pretty dramatic erosion of profit margins. Consensus EPS estimates are significantly lower, somewhere around 54 cents, and that directly reflects the heavy impact of the aggressive price cuts Tesla executed globally throughout the quarter. They did that to move inventory, yes, but also to fend off increasingly intense competition, particularly from Chinese EV makers like BYD. The market simply is not rewarding pure volume growth right now. It's demanding margin defense. Profitability is king.
But hold on, if Tesla is deliberately sacrificing margins now to gain or maintain market share against that rising Chinese competition, isn't that potentially a valid long-term strategy? How do the sources weigh that strategic trade-off versus the short-term margin hit?
That's a really fascinating strategic debate, but you know how Wall Street often operates? It tends to prefer predictability and near-term profitability over promises of long-term volume expansion at any cost. Our sources indicate the critical metric the market will absolutely key in on is the automotive gross margin, excluding regulatory credits. That's the pure measure of how profitably they're making and selling cars. This margin has reportedly compressed dramatically. Some estimates put it potentially settling around 17% for the quarter. That's a stark drop from its historic peaks, which were often above 25%, even touching 30% sometimes. If that margin number disappoints, comes in below 17%, or if management signals on the call that they intend to continue prioritizing market share at the expense of margin, the stock will almost certainly face major pressure because it fundamentally questions the long-term profitability model that underpins its high valuation.
Okay, so margin pressure is the core risk. Is there anything that could potentially offset that worry for investors? A positive surprise somewhere else.
The commentary on the future timeline for full self-driving, FSD, and the robo-taxi platform, that's the potential valuation hedge. Any concrete signs of progress or maybe an acceleration of those timelines announced on the call could trigger a sharp rally because it provides an immediate justification for maintaining a tech-level valuation, something that could override the margin pressures in the traditional auto manufacturing segment. And given Tesla's massive influence on sentiment, its post-earnings reaction often has the power to swing broader tech indices and overall risk appetite across the entire market. It's a real bellwether.
And beyond those tech giants, we also get some real-world readouts from industrial and consumer staples companies, right? Kind of a bottom-up reality check.
Exactly. We look to companies like Coca-Cola, KO, for insight into consumer spending habits, particularly on discretionary items, and the pricing power in the staples sector. Lockheed Martin, LMT, a major defense contractor, gives us a direct read on geopolitical stability perceptions and government spending trends, especially with ongoing conflicts. And crucially, we watch Lam Research, LRCX, which also reports Wednesday night. LRCX is a key bellwether for the semiconductor capital expenditure, or CapEx, cycle. If Lam signals a significant cutback in future CapEx spending plans by chipmakers, perhaps citing uncertainty over China's industrial output, or maybe weaker global end market demand for electronics, that sends a negative ripple across the entire tech and industrial landscape. Their results offer this granular bottom-up view that can either validate or contradict the broader macro picture that we get from things like the PMI surveys.
And finally, midweek, you mentioned we get a key housing and treasury test. What's that about?
Yeah, Wednesday afternoon features the U.S. Treasury auctioning off 20-year bonds. With the high level of U.S. Treasury issuance lately to fund the deficit, these auctions are really crucial tests of market demand for U.S. debt. Strong demand, where the final auction yield settles at or even below the levels where the bond was trading just before the auction, that's considered a smooth auction. That outcome eases fears about the market's capacity to absorb all this new debt, which helps put a cap on longer-term yields and is generally supportive for equities.
Okay, what happens if the auction is poor? You use the term tail in our prep.
Yeah.
How does that mechanism work and why is it banned?
Right. A poor auction, or one with a tail, happens when the demand for investors is weaker than expected. This forces the Treasury to offer a higher yield than where the market was trading beforehand, just to entice enough buyers to take down the full amount of bonds being offered. It often means the primary dealers the big banks obligated to bid get stuck holding a larger share of the debt than they really wanted. That pushes the overall yield curve higher. That kind of scenario underscores worries about the deficit, about future supply, and just generally poor demand sentiment for U.S. debt. So if this 20-year auction tails significantly, it could trigger a spike in yields across the curve, potentially pushing the critical 10-year Treasury yield above recent highs. That strengthens the U.S. dollar, but severely pressures rate-sensitive stocks like tech and real estate, and also hurts existing fixed-income assets. The market really watches these bond auctions almost as closely as the major data releases because they test the fundamental plumbing of global finance.
Okay, this is really the segment where the week's different threads seem to culminate into one high-stakes market test. Thursday and especially Friday morning Eastern time look like the global flashpoint, where that crucial inflation data, more corporate health checks, and those global activity surveys all collide. #tag 3.1, the inflation anchor.
This is it. The moment of truth arrives Friday morning, the U.S. CPI rescheduled data drop at 8:30 a.m. Eastern time.
We absolutely have to spend time on the mechanism here, as you said earlier. Because this release was postponed due to the shutdown, it's not just another monthly data point. It feels more like a pressure valve finally being released after weeks of buildup.
That's exactly the right way to think about it. We are talking about an extremely high-impact event, potentially the highest-stakes single CPI reading of the entire year. It will directly, immediately drive the narrative and the pricing around the Federal Reserve's future rate path. Now, consensus forecasts are hovering around 3.0% to 3.1% for headline CPI year over year, with core CPI stripping out food and energy expected near 3.2%. But honestly, the actual numbers might be less important than the market's reaction to any surprise, either higher or lower.
Tell us more about that reaction function. What does it mean practically when analysts say a hot print will lead to a repricing of Fed cut timing?
Okay, so it means the entire market, stocks, bonds, currencies, is currently positioned based on a forecast, an expectation for when the Fed will make its next move, specifically the date of the first expected rate cut. Many analysts and market pricing had penciled that in for maybe mid to late Q1 2026, or perhaps early Q2. If the CPI comes in hotter than expected, say core CPI prints above 3.2%, and especially if the details show that sticky services inflation isn't cooling fast enough, the market must immediately recalculate the probability of that Q1 or Q2 cut actually happening. Traders will instantly sell bonds, which pushes yields higher. They'll buy the U.S. dollar, anticipating the Fed will have to keep interest rates higher for a longer period than previously thought. So a hot print instantaneously pushes that expectation for the first rate cut further out, maybe deeper into 2026. That creates significant market volatility. You could easily see major equity indices drop 1%, maybe 2% or more, literally in the minutes following the release. Conversely, of course, a surprisingly soft print, particularly on the core side, would accelerate those cut expectations, likely triggering a significant relief rally in both stocks and bonds. Hashtag tag 3.2, the global growth pulse.
And almost simultaneously as this U.S. inflation bomb is dropping, we get the first really reliable snapshot of economic activity for October from around the globe. That comes courtesy of the flash PMIs. Given the lack of official U.S. data because of the shutdown, these private surveys are taking on magnified importance this month, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely critical this time around. The PMIs, the purchasing managers' indices, are so important because they are timely. They survey business managers directly about activity, new orders, employment, right at the start of the month. In the absence of reliable government data, especially from the U.S., they become the market's go-to proxy for gauging economic momentum.
So what are we expecting from the U.S. picture specifically?
We get the U.S. flash PMI reading at 9:45 a.m. Eastern on Thursday, October 24th, actually just before the CPI on Friday in this timeline. The composite consensus blending manufacturing and services is hovering near 51.5. A reading above 50 indicates expansion, so 51.5 suggests continued, albeit modest, growth. Crucially, though, the sources point to this ongoing bifurcation. Continued resilience, maybe even strength, in the services sector, but persistent softness, maybe even contraction, in manufacturing. So the U.S. economy appears fairly robust overall, but it's definitely uneven. Now, contrast that with what's expected in Europe. The Eurozone, Germany, and U.K. flash PMIs all drop early Friday morning, European time. The Eurozone composite PMI is expected somewhere near 49.5 to 50.0. Remember, below 50 indicates contraction, so Europe is flirting with stagnation or even mild recession. These are critical inputs for the European Central Bank's policy path.
Okay, so let's play that out. If Europe prints weak numbers, say around 49.5, confirming stagnation, while the U.S. holds relatively strong near 51.5, how does that translate into actual market movement?
It just dramatically sharpens that policy divergence theme we keep talking about. Weak Eurozone numbers confirm the region is struggling, likely reinforcing expectations that the European Central Bank will need to start easing policy sooner rather than later. This divergence typically spurs safe haven flows, money moving into perceived safety. That usually means flows into the U.S. dollar and U.S. treasuries. This would pressure the euro lower against the dollar and potentially make European stocks relatively less attractive compared to U.S. equities. It really emphasizes that global economic performance is not synchronized at all right now. Different regions are on very different tracks.
And on the same day, Thursday, we also have some significant policy decisions abroad.
That's right. The Bank of Korea, BOK, holds its monetary policy decision, likely announced late Wednesday night U.S. time or early Thursday morning. Given the ongoing growth concerns across Asia, probably exacerbated if Monday's China data confirms weakness, the market consensus widely anticipates a 25 basis point rate cut from the BOK, taking their policy rate down to 2.50%. If they deliver that cut, it signals a continued easing cycle in the region, which is generally seen as risk positive, supportive for Asian markets. Also on Thursday, we have the Central Bank of the Republic of Turkey, TCMB, rate decision. Turkey is expected to maintain its aggressive tightening stance. Rates likely stay very high consensus, around 39%, given the persistent pressure on the Turkish lira and the ongoing need to restore credibility and stability in emerging market currencies.
We also have the European Council Summit running Thursday and Friday, October 23rd and 24th. Geopolitics again.
Yes, this summit brings EU leaders together, focusing again on those ongoing chronic crises. Continued support for Ukraine, the situation in the Middle East, and longer-term issues around EU defense and competitiveness. Now, we aren't looking for instant major market reactions from summit declarations usually, but the sources do highlight two key potential market implications to watch for. First, any signs of consensus on new significant sanctions against Russia. That would likely be bearish for European energy prices, particularly natural gas. Second, any tangible moves or commitments towards joint EU defense spending or procurement initiatives. That would generally be viewed as bullish for European defense contractors and related stocks, as it signals a long-term fiscal commitment to military integration and capability building. #tag 3.3, consumer staples and housing checks.
Okay, bringing it back to the U.S. consumer health check, Procter & Gamble earnings drop before the market opens on Thursday.
Right, P&G, PG earnings. They serve as a really definitive gauge of consumer resilience, especially for everyday necessities, and also corporate pricing power in the consumer staples sector. As a classic defensive stock, steady results are generally expected. Analysts anticipate organic sales growth, which strips out currency effects and acquisitions, somewhere around 5% to 6%. Since P&G sells essential household goods, detergent, diapers, toothpaste, the critical question for investors digging into the results is whether consumers are starting to trade down to cheaper private label or store brands, and also, can P&G maintain its profit margins in the face of potentially still rising commodity input costs? If their organic sales growth is primarily driven by volume increases, that's seen as healthy. But if it's entirely driven by price hikes while volume is flat or even declining, that's a worrying sign that consumers are under stress and might be cutting back.
And finally, housing data. This provides another crucial piece of the U.S. consumer puzzle, although you mentioned it could be a potentially misleading picture.
Yes. The U.S. existing home sales data for September is due out on Thursday. The headline number is expected to be around 3.9 million units on an annualized basis, but our sources really highlight a dangerous fragility and a sharp bifurcation within the housing market right now that investors absolutely must understand. The headline sales number is essentially being masked or propped up by the activity of cash-heavy buyers.
How significant is this masking effect? Can you quantify that?
It's extremely significant. The recent data shows that the proportion of cash-heavy buyers, often older, boomer generation buyers, who are largely immune to high mortgage rates because they don't need financing, they now make up a staggering 42% of all existing home buyers. The segment of the market is basically keeping the transaction volume from collapsing entirely and is also supporting prices in many areas. But this activity is masking the underlying structural weakness elsewhere. Because, conversely, the share of rate-sensitive first-time buyers has plummeted to a historic low, just 24% of the market. These are the buyers who are most sensitive to today's high mortgage rates, affordability challenges, and the broader economic health. They're effectively locked out. Therefore, digging into the regional breakdown within the National Association of Realtors, NAR data, and looking at the composition of the buyer pool is far more important this month than just looking at the headline sales figure. A seemingly strong or stable headline number could actually be hiding a complete paralysis in the younger, more rate-sensitive segments of the economy. It shows that the U.S. housing market is really only functioning on one cylinder right now.
All right. Wrapping up the week's calendar, we have a handful of key political and regulatory events over the weekend and into the start of the next week. These can set the stage and impact regional risk sentiment moving forward.
That's right. The weekend itself is actually quite heavy with political tests, particularly in Latin America. We have the Bolivian presidential runoff happening on Sunday, October 19th. But the potentially more high-stakes event is the Argentina legislative elections on Sunday, October 26th. These midterms are going to function as a crucial voter referendum on the continuity of the current administration's pretty drastic shock therapy economic policies. The results will deeply impact the trajectory of the Argentine peso, investor sentiment towards Argentine assets, and maybe even broader emerging market debt. A poor showing by the ruling coalition could immediately raise concerns about policy instability and future sovereign credit risk.
And over in Asia, the ASEAN summit convenes on Sunday, October 26 as well.
Yeah, this summit is important for emerging market Asia sentiment, especially as the agenda focuses heavily on regional trade dynamics and ongoing supply chain issues. Leaders will be discussing economic integration within Southeast Asia, but critically, also how regional supply chains are adapting to that accelerating trend of U.S.-China decoupling or de-risking. For investors, the discussions and communiqués coming out of the ASEAN summit can provide signals on where future manufacturing investment might flow and which countries are positioning themselves successfully for supply chain diversification away from China. #4.2 crypto and regulatory deadlines.
We also have a very specific regulatory event happening midweek that could potentially unlock significant new capital flows into the often volatile crypto asset space.
Yes. Thursday, October 24th marks the culmination of a wave of crypto ETF decisions that have been pending before the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC. Following the frameworks that were established earlier with the Bitcoin and Ethereum spot ETF approvals, the SEC now faces final decision deadlines for multiple ETFs based on other major altcoins tokens like XRP, Solana, maybe even Doge mentioned.
And what are the market expectations here? Is approval seen as likely?
Analyst estimates, based on the precedent set, suggest a reasonably high probability of multiple altcoin ETF approvals this time around. If approved, it means regulated investment products tracking these tokens would become available on mainstream financial platforms, accessible to brokers, and potentially retirement accounts. An approval wave would likely catalyze a significant rally, specifically in those approved altcoins, driven by the anticipation and then the reality of fresh institutional capital inflows seeking diversification beyond just Bitcoin and Ethereum. It's seen as a massive structural tailwind for the broader crypto ecosystem. Of course, an unexpected blanket denial or denial of key applications would sharply hit prices and cast renewed doubt on the future regulatory environment for digital assets in the US.
And lastly, on the cyber risk front, there's a deadline for federal agencies that kind of highlights these ongoing structural security concerns.
That's the CISA Emergency Directive 2501 deadline, which falls on Wednesday, October 22nd. CISA is the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. This directive requires federal agencies to patch certain critical vulnerabilities found in F5 network appliances, which are widely used. It highlights the constant structural need for vigilant risk management in cybersecurity. While not a direct market mover itself, these kinds of deadlines serve as reminders for investors that IT security is a continuous high-cost operational requirement for businesses and governments alike. It's a theme that tends to increase investment interest in the cyber defense sector stocks over time. Hashtag tag outro.
So what does this all mean? Wow, we've just cut through an unbelievably packed and potentially volatile week, running all the way from China's economic checkup on Monday right through to that high-stakes U.S. CPI release on Friday. Let's try and synthesize this. What are the three major takeaways that really define the investment environment coming out of this week?
Okay, I think the first big takeaway is that the macro environment is just defined by extreme policy divergence. You have the Bank of England remaining notably hawkish, worried about core inflation and wages. But at the same time, we see clear easing signals, or at least strong anticipation of easing, from the Bank of Korea, probably the Bank of Canada soon, and the potential, however delayed, for the Fed to eventually ease as well. This divergence creates massive pressure points and volatility in G10 currency pairs like euro-dollar or sterling-dollar. Regional bond markets will perform very differently, and it really necessitates careful management of duration risk in portfolios.
Right. Divergence is key. What's the second major theme?
The second takeaway is that corporate health is now firmly centered around the margin battle. The earnings results this week from Tesla to Netflix to P&G, they all confirm that investors are prioritizing the quality of earnings, meaning margin expansion, over just simple volume growth or top-line beats. We saw this so starkly illustrated by the market's likely punitive focus on any margin compression at Tesla, contrasting sharply with the monetization prowess investors demand from Netflix. Essentially, a top-line revenue beat driven by healthy expansion of the gross margin is bullish. A beat driven primarily by aggressive cost-cutting or price cuts that happened amidst falling margins is increasingly seen as bearish and ultimately unsustainable.
Okay, policy divergence, the margin battle, and the third key takeaway.
And the third, I think, is that data reliability is tested right now. The U.S. government shutdown dramatically elevates the importance of timely private sector data, especially those global flash PMIs, which are basically serving as the only reliable first look at economic activity in October for many regions, including the U.S. This scarcity of official U.S. data makes that rescheduled U.S. CPI on Friday an exceptionally high-stakes, must-watch event. It really is the single anchor point for global volatility this week, capable of completely repricing the entire forward interest rate curve in an instant. You know, the sources reveal that while, yes, there are acute geopolitical events happening, the fragility around the Gaza ceasefire, the European Council tackling Ukraine, the true underlying risk weaving through this entire week seems to lie in the chronic structural conditions. We're talking about that persistent Chinese deflation we dug into, the effects of U.S.-China decoupling fundamentally reshaping supply chains, and the very narrow rate-sensitive nature of the U.S. housing recovery, which, as we discussed, is currently being masked by those cash-rich buyers. So the provocative thought maybe to leave you with is this. We know these chronic structural weaknesses exist, but which one, the persistent Chinese deflation, the potential for further margin erosion in key tech sectors, or the hidden fragility of the U.S. housing market, which of these chronic issues will be the one that finally triggers the next acute and immediate market shock? That underlying question, I think, is really defining risk appetite for the rest of the year.